Hello, friends, family, and everyone in between. Welcome back to another episode of the Mental Corner Podcast, the show where I bring on guests from all different backgrounds to talk all the things mental health. I'm your host, Harry Pavin, here in the great white north of Canada. I mean, seriously, if you are here up north in Ontario, this morning, what day is it today? It's Tuesday. This is going to be released on Thursday, so hopefully the weather's a little better. But this morning, I walked out of my house and my mustache immediately froze. It's just like, come on, Canada, okay, Christmas is done, New Year's is done, we're in the new year, let's just get rid of the snow, please. I was really feeling the Canadian stereotype. I thought I would open my door and my freaking polar bear was going to come pick me up for work. Like, it's way too cold right now. With that being said, I hope you are keeping warm, safe, and healthy wherever you are listening from in the world. Please join me in welcoming our guest for the show, Alex Calabrese. Alex is a writer and singer for the band Old Tom and the Lookouts, which is a Boston-based indie folk band that creates hopeful and evocative music surrounding mental health. Their most recent album, Just for Beasts, is now available for streaming everywhere. And let me tell you, I absolutely love this album, not just because Alex was a guest on the show, but because it really is just a great album with a great message around mental health. They did a fantastic job with this album. So be sure to check that out and more in the links that I've provided down below. And I really want to thank Alex again for coming on and having this discussion with me. And before we get into the episode today, guys, you know the drill. If you're listening, please like, comment, share, subscribe, give 5 stars if you're on that podcast platform. Share with someone who might want to hear this episode. It's a really great one, and I can't wait for you to listen. I'll talk to y'all very soon. Have a great rest of your day. Peace. Alex, now that it is recorded, thank you so much for coming on, man. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me. This is awesome. I really, really am happy to have the opportunity.
Of course. I'm excited to have you on. And I think the first question that I have for you is, what kind of got you started into music? Like, what was the push for you?
Honestly, when I was a teenager, I was trying to figure out how to express my feelings, and I couldn't do it in a way that was like, I felt like it was weird. I grew up just a little ways north of New York City, about like an hour and a half to 2 hours. So it's really strange being so close to somewhere that is the epicenter of like culture in the 90s and for the US. Mm-hmm. And for that to be such a formative time, you know, to figure that all the opinions and ideas that I wanted to express were a little far left for where I was growing up. And there are a lot of my friends growing up were from very conservative, very religious families. And I was really frustrated by a lot of that stuff. And, you know, seeing in the 90s and in the early 2000s when I was growing up, it was just really frustrating to see all the social and political stuff that was happening. And I, you know, for the longest time, I wanted to just be like, hey, George Bush is an asshole, not have like one of my friends' moms be like, you should never talk about the president that way. So I was like, I need to put this in music so that my incredibly narrow-minded friends don't understand what I'm talking about, because as many of us know, metaphors are lost on the far right. So that was pretty easy to evade. Yeah, so that's how.
Awesome. Was that your first song title?
Metaphors Evade the Far Right?
Yeah.
It might as well have been. I wrote so much political, like, punk rock music when I was a kid, and it was terrible. It was probably just like, it was all inspired by bands like Anti-Flag and Rise Against, and it was just like really amelodic stuff that, it was mostly about just kind of screaming all of your emotions and how angry you are to the sound of power chords, which is punk rock.
Right, yeah.
But then slowly I matured, very slowly I matured, to writing some more thoughtful lyrics about how I was like actually feeling, or why I was actually feeling angry, and identifying, you know, what it is to be anxious and what it is to be depressed without the boatloads of Catholic guilt and shame that come with all of, you know, growing up in that region of New York and stuff. So that was like I said, it was a very slow process that got me to being able to write a concise message about what I was truly feeling about myself and for myself. And that I found to be something that was best carried by folk music, which is, you know, just very, very largely focused on lyrics. So that's kind of how all of that evolved, to make a long story longer.
How did you get introduced to folk music?
Honestly, my dad. So my dad he still is a very big Paul Simon and Simon and Garfunkel. And honestly, my parents both grew up in New York, and through the 60s, 70s, and 80s, just got to experience that entire like folk revolution scene that took place there, and the aftermath of that, and all of the, you know, the way that spread up into the Hudson Valley and all of that, my parents got to experience, which was so cool to know that my dad got to see Simon and Garfunkel in Central Park. Like, that's so cool. That's so cool. I would love to have that opportunity. You know, but it's one of those things that, that kind of makes this like really, really cool idea very tangible, you know, to be able to have that relationship connected to that experience, and then to be able to play that music and learn that music guided by somebody who had that experience was just so cool for me. And that was like, oh well, this is how you share those thoughts and emotions that are so, so vulnerable and honest. And that was such a big thing for me. It was the honesty component, because growing up in the 90s and early 2000s, we got to experience some of the most monetized versions of what music and art could be, you know, because some, like, in no other 2 decades could a band like Three Doors Down ever find success. Right. That's like the definition of butt rock, right? Like, it's like, they voluntarily played at Trump's inauguration. There's no, you know, in no other universe, at no other time, do bands like that succeed, right? It's just, it's 100% a monetization of that. So I was always feeling like, man, this music is like that, music that is so prevalently on the radio, you know, it just felt like that can't be something that this person actually thinks. Like, there's no way this person thinks so highly but also so lowly of themselves. Like, right. It's just an over dramatization of these extremes because that's what's going to sell.
Right.
So there's no genuine sincerity to it whatsoever. So for me, I was just like, why don't I just take all the ugly words and all the ugly feelings and all of the shit that, you know, it's clearly why I'm 32 and still living right in the mid-level of whatever notoriety I'm going to get. Why don't I just find a way to package that so that people like me can like this? So it's relatively niche, I guess, but it's, you know, it's what makes me feel like I'm creating an honest piece of art. Right. That allows me to be able to say, like, well, selling out might be a bullshit idea, but also so is creating anything that you don't truly believe in. So fuck it, you know.
Right.
Let's just make something honest, and if somebody likes that, that's great. If somebody doesn't like it, at least I tried being honest, you know.
Right. Yeah, I mean, like, imagine making it big, being someone you're not. It happens all the time.
Chad Kroeger, your Canadian star child.
Yeah, well, I don't even know who that is.
That's the guy from Nickelback.
Oh, that's kind of embarrassing. I should have known that.
Oh, no.
Oh, I'm about to get roasted. Yeah, exactly. It's just like, yeah. You might as well just stay true to yourself.
Right? That's the one thing that folk music has taught me. There's a lot of bullshit folk out there too, I'm sure, you know, and it's been, you know, every kind of music has gone through the different kind of equations and algorithms to create some some fantastic version of it that's going to appeal to everybody. Right. But I feel like, you know, the good stuff is always just below the surface, and it's always, you know, it's always the honest music, I would say.
Yeah, 100%. Now, was there ever a hesitancy for you when you first started out to do the folk music as opposed to the selling out? Because there's always, like, yes, you know, it's more ideal to stay true to yourself, but there's always that component of, ooh, I could make a lot of money, or I could gain a lot of notoriety here. Like, was there ever that hesitancy for you for which path you wanted to take?
Honestly, if I always had the option to sell out, I probably would have sold out at one point or another. Money is a crucial piece of being a musician, and nobody wants to pay us. Even the nice people don't want to pay us.
Right.
and you know, if I had the option to sell out, I'm sure at some point I would have been like, Warner Brothers, come right. on, let's See fucking you. Go. I'm going to write songs about fucking, you know, how cool it is to be in the club, and that's great, or drinking or something like that. But to answer your question, I never hesitated about putting art over marketing and art over really any other piece of professional or career-centered life. I don't have anything against anybody who has found art in PR or finding art in marketing, because it exists. There's a true art form of being able to do that. But I've always been somebody who is so hyper-focused on creating authentic art, authentic to me.
Right.
And I think that can render many, many different products, but very few of them have a ton of space for being centered around the marketability of something. You know, if I have an ugly message to send, I might dress it up a little bit, but it's still going to be that ugly message. Maybe it's about depression, maybe it's about anxiety, but it's going to really embrace the ugly part of that, and always and only to the ends of being able to embrace the hopeful side of that, and that's art to share. That's art to share in, you know. So in order to share it, we do need the marketing side. So I'm not going to poo-poo on any of that. But right. That's never been something that I've ever been able to embrace amongst my skill sets as a career musician.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, I love the messages you send, because there's two different sides of the music industry, and I feel like you almost need both. I mean, you need those records where you're partying at the club and you feel like $1 million, because, hey, I mean, sometimes you need a pick-me-up, but you also need the side that's vulnerable and honest and that people can look to when they're feeling like they're the only person in the world that's ever going through anything.
Yeah, that, you know, one of the things, so I mentioned earlier how Cecilia and I just recently did an interview with Montclair University, or Montclair State University. They're down just outside of New York in New Jersey. And one of the things we talked about with the music director over there, who's in charge of, or the radio director, I'm blanking on the exact title, but one of the things that we really wanted to make sure was 100% clear was that so much of the ethos that goes into making our music is really to provide that togetherness and support to our listeners that I was able to feel, particularly as the lyricist, to other listeners, because I got so much support from musicians I'd never met, you know, like bands like Frightened Rabbit or Julian Baker or Tom Waits or Bruce Springsteen, these amazing storytellers, these brilliant, brilliant songwriters who, when I was feeling really shitty, I was like, man, it's not just me.
Right.
And I can feel this. Not only can I feel it, I can tell somebody about this feeling, you know, instead of, you know, this, like, again, instead of those real extremes that were presented by what's on the radio, whether it's like we're profiting off of somebody who's really, 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 really sad, or we're profiting off of somebody who's unnaturally jubilant and happy. And it's just like the combination of the two. It's just so polarizing that when you get something that's honest and true and authentic, and it really just connects with you on a soulful level, you know, which is really what we wanted to do, to pay it forward, kind of as musicians who have, we have been consumers of this art forever, and I want to be able to give somebody something back, you know?
Right, yeah. Carry the tradition. That.
Yeah, I guess so. I imagine that there's about 40% of that message that might feel like bullshit, but I truly mean it. Really, it's you know, if I were in something for the money to sell out, I wouldn't be writing folk music, you know? If I could do anything else, who knows? But fuck it, man. You know, it's about authenticity.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, when you first started, you know, being honest in your music about what you were personally dealing with and the things that you were seeing around and everything, like, was there ever, like, was it scary for you to first start being honest in your music? Because knowing that your friends and family and people you didn't even know were going to hear this stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. That was horrifying. That was really scary because in the last several years, I've been able to get the help that I've needed for a really long time, which is, therapeutically speaking, seeing a therapist, seeing a psychiatrist, having been hospitalized, being diagnosed with things that I always thought were applicable, but never had that concrete diagnosis from a doctor to be able to like say, oh fuck, I'm bipolar. Right. That's why I feel like this. That explains that group of years that was pure shit. Mm-hmm. That explains that group of days or weeks or months where I was hypomanic as fuck, just like churning out, you know, 35 songs that all sounded the same and they all sucked. And I wrote them all at 2 a.m. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And now I know what to call that. And there's a community of people that have lived that same exact kind of lifestyle. And we haven't been talking about them nearly enough in a way that might let them know that there's a community. There are more of us. No, it's like, it's just that there's, you know, there's a support group out there that we don't even know about. And I want this music to be able to clue people into that. And I remember experiencing suicidal ideation as young as my preteens and wanting to write about that, but having that manifestation of anger represent itself in, like, you know, fuck you poems to George Bush and all of the other terrible, terrible, terrible people out there. And, you know, and just not knowing how to represent that. And then as I got more into actually trying to weave those messages into my music, it was so much more subtle. And now it's now it's almost gotten to the point where it's just like, you know, in the most recent album, we have, you know, we have songs like Love in a Hospital and Graveyard versus Hot Air Balloon and all of these songs that really, really depict the mental and emotional strain that goes into being a part of this community of folks suffering from mental illness, particularly folks suffering from bipolar and depression and anxiety, but only speaking for what I have experienced firsthand, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Now, have you, like, did writing the music and making the music at the beginning and then continuing, did it ever help you with, you know, your own self-worth or your self-love? Like, did it ever improve it in any way?
No. Oh. Sorry. I don't know. It's really hard. I hated myself for a really long time with many, many reasons substantiated for myself. Because I was just very unhappy. It took me a really long time to find worth in myself and what I was creating and why my worth was elevated by that which I was creating, because it was hopeful, because it was for help. Right. And until I could really, this sounds like a shitty lead up to like a pyramid scheme pitch here. Like until I was actualized, until I was really like into understanding that this is what I could do, and that this is what I am actually good at, and this is what I was actually gaining confidence in after never having any confidence, you know, it only, I would say that only dawned on me in like the last like 5 years, man. Mm. Like, you know, I'm 32 years old, and if math is accurate, 27 was the changing point, and a big, you know, granted, I met my fiance, you know, in 2000, Jesus Christ, fuck. I hope Julia never listens to this. I met her in 2017 or 2018. She's not going to listen to this. I know she's not going to listen to it. But
you get back. You get back. You're like, don't you dare listen to what I just did.
I'm so sorry. I'm sorry. No, that was kind of like a hump for me. To find that this magical person. That was the awakening for me, was that this magical person wanted to spend time with me, and saw worth in me, and that helped me start to see that worth in myself. And I know that sounds really schmaltzy, but that's the truth, man. And that is not anything that defines it. No other person defines you as a person. I truly believe that. But I think that for some people, it's an integral moment to notice that there is somebody who can love you as much as you hate yourself. And there's this crazy, crazy moment of actualization where you're just like, maybe I'm not that bad. Mm. Maybe I'm not that shitty. And it takes a while. You know, and a lot of the emails that I answer, or a lot of the questions that I get from interview folks, have a lot to do with basically the message that we want to send with our music. And it's that everybody's worth it, and that everybody deserves to come to that point of realizing their self-worth. And for me, it took decades to realize that there was any part of me that felt worth it. And being able to realize some of that now, I can only attribute it to finding true love in a relationship that creates that reciprocity that helps make you feel, you know, and right. Make you feel worth it, which is crazy, because, you know, it's a shame to think that there are people out there that might never find that, and there are other ways to find that self-worth. But for me, it was this, and I'm so glad that I did.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And when you got that love and you started gaining that confidence, was it kind of like a snowball effect? Like, did the momentum keep going, or were there other things that you had to do in order to really start to get that self-worth going?
It definitely was a work in progress. It was challenging, more for the fact of trying to figure out why I deserved this love. And that was really hard for me. For a number of years, in the beginning of our relationship, there was a lot of me that wasn't totally opened up to the fact that I deserved that love. So I think that there was an inherent withholding of specific trusts and giving that I could have been doing that entire time, which, understanding gratitude and understanding unconditional love, was such a big piece of my own personal growth in discovering my self-worth. Because when I found out that I could give more and that I could be a part of something that's so much bigger than me, I was like, that's it. That's what this was the whole time. Mm. This is what I've been missing, you know? And it's not, again, not to be identified by a person or a relationship, but there's so much that I learned about myself in finding that big stupid love.
Right. Yeah, no, that's awesome. Now,
yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Now when did like Old Tom and the Lookouts form? Was it around that time or was it a little bit later?
It was much later. Much later. Yeah, so me and Cecilia started talking about forming. So I was touring with this band. I mentioned earlier when I was touring through like Toronto and the Midwest and stuff, I was touring with this band, Old Fox. We had a great time. And over the pandemic, all of us kind of grew apart from the music, and it was so hard to keep creating music during that time as something that was a collective indie rock band. It was just hard to keep that up. So the goal was, for me, Old Tom and the Lookouts began as a solo adventure where I was just like, okay, I want to write these songs that are honest and true to me, and I'm not writing with a collective. I'm not writing with anybody in mind other than how I can tell this story the best. And I started writing with a dear friend of mine, Jacob McCurdy, and I think over the course of like 8 months, we wrote close to like almost 40 songs for each other. And it was just like this crazy, crazy just grouping of just music that we really believed in. And I brought it to Cecilia Vacanti, who's a fiddler in Old Tom and the Lookouts and a dear friend. I was like, what can you do with this? I want to make an album out of this. And she put her stamp on it. And then we had the first Old Tom and the Lookouts record, which was as much effort as we put into it. And as proud as we were, it was pretty half cocked. Because I feel like a lot of first records for people, particularly as a result of the pandemic, I'm sure that we were not the only people releasing like these albums that should have had significantly more go into them. But we did that, and we had a little bit of a lineup change. And Cecilia and I remained to be like the core two members of the band. And now Old Tom and the Lookouts can be represented as Cecilia and I, or Cecilia, myself, Jake, Jacob McCurdy will play bass or sing backup. Steve Dennis, Jesse Da Silva, all of these amazing local New England musicians, we get the privilege of being able to play with them as both, you know, bandmates and collaborators. And we've kind of made the Lookouts this like rotating cast of folks who will come in and play with us, and like we'll play club passing with like a five piece or a four piece, and then Cecilia and I will go play a house show with just the two of us, and we're able to create this dynamic group of folks that are just so excited about, and I should also mention Jack Byrne, mm-hmm. Plays banjo with us. We're able to create this really dynamic group of people who, or we didn't create them, but work with these folks who help us relay this message, and it's amazing. And folks we haven't been able to play with that have participated in the project so far and collaborated, folks like Connor Storms, Zach Conley, and Michael Day, and all these other people who are just like really in their own respect so fucking talented and so such staples of their own scenes. And we've been able to work with them, and they've been able to help us out in getting this cool project off the ground, and for nothing but kind of faith in the fact that this project could be something. And that feels great. It feels really, really fucking good. So it's, yeah, I kind of went on a tangent there, but yeah, mostly it's just Cecilia and I, and anybody out of that cast of folks who is available and ready to hop in on shows with us.
No, that's awesome. No,
yeah, it's yeah, great.
That's awesome. Like, was it difficult for you guys to organize everything amidst the pandemic because you're not all together? I feel like that would be challenging.
It was pretty tricky. You know, it after the first revamping of who Connor or who Old Tom, I almost said this band that we're playing with in like 2 weeks, Connor and the Wild Hunt. That's us now. So who Old Tom and the Lookouts was after we really changed who that was as the core group, it became so much easier for us to do it organizationally because we just weren't working with the right people right away. And that in and of itself was creating challenges that Cecilia and I didn't recognize at the time, but fully recognize now. Is just, it's, you know, it's like dating, right? If you're dating somebody and it's like really, really hard in the first 3 months, it's probably not going to fucking work. It's probably not going to work, you know?
Tell that to young me.
I'm so sorry. Well, it's just like, you know, you get, there's such thing as like infatuation. It exists far, far beyond the person to person relationship. It's, you know, you can have many, many different people fall in love with the idea of something, and to realize that the compatibility just isn't there is a very, very challenging thing to do. And it's honestly, it takes a great deal of maturity and selflessness for somebody to be able to step back from something and say like, you know what, this isn't what I wanted, and I don't think I'm going to help this project. And that's a huge thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a scary move too.
It is a scary move, you know, putting yourself out on a limb like that, or separating yourself from folks. It's just such a definitive action that, again, it all goes back to like that, like, okay, can I exist on my own? You know, no relationship defines one person. But if you truly believe that, then that's not anything you're ever going to be able to step away from, right?
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've definitely done that where I put all my worth and value into a relationship.
Yeah.
Like, without this relationship, I'm nothing.
Yeah, that kind of thing, I think, is more often the situation, isn't it?
I amongst people I know, for sure, their whole identity is the relationship.
Yeah.
And they get out and they're like, who the fuck am I?
Yeah. And especially in a time during the pandemic where you're looking at so many different relationships turn over because of where those relationships were in their own, you know, respectively speaking, in those definitions, like, maybe one person was like, this relationship is who I am. And the other person is like, my God, why does this relationship have to be who I am? And it was like, fuck, now we have a sitcom from the 90s.
Oh, man. Yeah, exactly. When, when the pandemic actually hit, like, how were you personally able to kind of stay level-headed in the sense of like, you know, the whole world's going to shit and everyone's sitting in their house like, what is going on? And just frustrated and angry. How were you able to stay level-headed? Did music ever play a part in that?
Yeah, music was, you know, again, music was, again, one of the big saviors there. I was writing with Jacob almost twice a week consistently, at which point the pandemic hit, and the two of us were just like, it's time to write a bunch of fucking music and it's going to be great. And we're going to pour all our feelings out. He'd just broken up with this person, and I'd just really kind of got to a point where I wasn't sure about my role in Old Fox anymore. Sure if I was being valued as much as I wanted to be there. I wasn't sure if I was, if I was getting as much from it as I was putting in. And so we were both, one significantly different than the other. We were both going through big changes, and then the pandemic hit, and it was just like, okay, well, now we just have to roll with this, right? Mm. So let's just do it. We did the Zoom sessions. Basically, Jake was up in Kittery, Maine, and I was down here in Grafton, Massachusetts, just outside of Boston. And we started doing these writing sessions, and they were, aside from my personal relationships, those writing sessions were what kept music alive for me during the pandemic, and are the sole reason for Old Tom and the Lookouts being anything. I attribute it all to my writing sessions with Jake.
Right. Now, did any of that music go into the album?
Oh, yeah. So the first album, Beautiful or my God, Beautiful or Not, is our first release. And that record is almost entirely songs collaborated on by Jacob and I. And Cecilia, Jake, and I, two other members of Old Tom and the Lookouts, who are no longer with us, helped produce and mix and master and also play violin on those. And we really came up with some beautiful work for that record. And then shortly after that was done, I went into like super, super hypomanic kind of situation. And I wrote all of, if not most of, Just for Beasts in about like a month.
Mm, wow.
And it was like right after Beautiful or Not released that I started really diving into that. 'Cause there were a lot of really, really tense things that happened in the release of Beautiful or Not that kind of spiked me into a bit of a manic state. And when I get like that, I'm just like, how do I write? I must write these feelings away. And right. Yeah, that was what I did. Man. So.
Now, do you, like, after this whole journey and process and everything, like, do you still experience challenges with your own personal issues with mental illness and mental health? Like, when you feel those dips in your mental health, like, how do you personally deal with it or take care of it?
For me, I've just recently been introduced to a really helpful mood stabilizer that's helped kind of keep me in the margins or outside, sorry, out of the margins, I should say.
Keep them right in there.
Yeah, keep me right in the margin. I would love to be as low as possible, as consistently as possible, please. keeping me right in that sweet spot, which has been great. It's been a little over a month now that I've been on that, which was really helpful. But aside from that, medication has been crucial. So nobody should listen to Kanye West about not taking medicine when you're bipolar. We should all take medicine. If you have pneumonia, you take medicine to fix your lungs.
Mm-hmm.
We just have that in our brains. And chemically, medicine is the cat's pajamas. We should absolutely be doing that. And honestly, for other self-care things, a lot of it is focused around quality time with my fiance. That's huge. We have two dogs, one of which is right over here. You can see his little red collar. We have Barry and Margaret. They're really helpful for care, going on walks and stuff like that. If I'm feeling particularly low, Julia will notice and be like, I think that we should go on a walk. Mm. And that's really helpful. Physical fitness is pretty helpful too. I don't do nearly as much as I should, but I'll get in a couple workouts and go on some runs occasionally, or go on a bike ride. That's really helpful for me as well. But also writing is really helpful, and practicing gratitude, like truly living in gratitude, has been something that's been able to help me sometimes remove myself from the equation when I need to, in order to get a bigger view on what's actually happening. And I don't mean to sound like I'm just like quoting the mindfulness app. I mean that in terms of, you know, it's why I like to cook dinner for my family is because I'm grateful to have people to cook for. It's why I clean the house. It's because I'm grateful to be able to provide a clean space for people to live in. It's why I write music, to be able to provide art for people who need art, and for myself, because I need that art too, because I want to create something I haven't heard yet that I want to hear, and because I want to write a message that is very similar to the same action as journaling. It's really all very, very similar to a lot of many, many assigned therapeutic bits of homework that you'll get from, you know, a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, that's been a huge piece of my own self-care.
Right.
Awesome. How about you? What do
Me?
You do?
With self-care?
Yeah.
Man, I mean, I also practice gratitude as well. I try to do that as often as I can, just because, I mean, I'm sure you can relate to this. Like, it's so easy for me to just fall out of perspective and just think the world's crumbling around me. So just being able to pause that, take a step back and go, look at the big picture, bro. You're fine. Like, everything's good. So that, physical fitness as well. I do Muay Thai. I try to do yoga, because I used to be a swimmer. And so when I sit down for too long, I get anxious because I'm what am I doing? So being able to move and get that anxiety out is really good for me. Sound baths. I don't know if you know what sound baths. Do you know what those are?
No. What is that?
It's like this. You can find it on YouTube. It's like a dude or a girl that just like sits in a room full of bowls and they just use the stick thing to make these vibrations from the bowl, and you put headphones on and it just goes through and you feel like you're getting cleaned. It's weird. It's a weird feeling, but I try to do that twice a week at least. And I'll go like into the actual bath and have a sound bath and just cleanse myself. So that's definitely another one. I think that's a big one too. And reading. I like to read. I used to, when I was a kid, that was my escape from reality, was reading. So, you know, before it was all fiction and it was like science fiction and whatever it was, but now it's more like history of the world and how animals live and how things work. So
it's so cool
being able to distract myself with that stuff. That's huge for me.
That's awesome, man. Can you send me a link for the sound bath shit that you use? Because that sounds like exactly what I want to do tonight when I get home from my gig. I just want to completely zone out and be like, I am washed in sound.
It's so crazy, man. Like the
sounds so cool.
The people will sit there for 5-6 hours and just move a stick around a bowl. I'm definitely like downplaying it, but that's what it is. It's just like this stick with a bowl and just like
that meditative stuff can be so cool. Mm-hmm. I used to be an athlete as well. I played competitive soccer for like 18 years.
Oh man.
And yeah. So my, if I'm not, you know, if I'm not moving, what am I doing kind of stuff sets into my brain in a big way. Especially cause it's like the physical fitness that used to go into playing specific positions that I used to play in soccer was just constant movement. That would, and as a swimmer, it's completely, you know, like I lifeguarded, which is nothing close to being a swimmer, but I remember having to swim 10 laps and I felt like I was fucking gassed at the end of that shit. I could run 5 miles at like a bolt for soccer and rugby, and you ask me to swim 10 laps and I'm fucked.
Yeah.
Like sideways. Like there's no way that I could, I would die. I would get into a pool right now, swim 2 laps, and I would have you would have to extract me from the pool with some sort of device because I would be a dead fish. Yeah. Do you still swim?
No, I actually finished my career right before the pandemic hit, like a month before. It was great timing.
Yeah.
It was kind of tough because like I'm sure you've experienced this where when you're done sports, it's kind of like, what now?
Yeah.
So when the pandemic hit, it was even more of a what now. So I just gained a ton of weight.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's what a lot of us did during the pandemic. I've gained a substantial amount of weight during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And it is what it is, baby. It's just like there's nothing we can do about it. I like ice cream. Way too much.
Man, I know.
Ice cream is just far too delicious for me. I have cut out almost entirely red meat, though.
Mm.
Almost cut out red meat. I was very proud of that. I will have a steak maybe once a month.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Chicken burgers. I make solid. A mean chicken thigh burger.
Ooh.
It's good. Yeah.
Oh man. Chicken. Yeah, like, that's the one I can't. That's the reason I can't go vegan is chicken.
Yeah. Oh yeah. There's too much. There's something about chicken thigh that will just, that'll be the flavor that seasoned a little salt. That's fucking, that will be what I can eat. I'll eat that until I am on my deathbed.
In the coffin, just eating a chicken thigh.
Yeah, just put me in there with a chicken thigh, cooked, preferably. Of course. If I'm dead, it doesn't matter. Just put a raw one in there.
That's true, but out of respect.
Out of respect, you would have cooked it.
It's got to be
cooked. If you respected me, you would have cooked it.
Oh my god, that's hilarious. Was there, like, on this new project, Just for Beasts? Yeah. I listened to it all last night and all this. I love the project. And that's not me saying that because you're a guest. That's me genuinely saying I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Was there a song on there? Were any of the songs particularly special for you to write? Like, was there one personal favorite for you?
Just for Beasts was definitely Just for Beasts. And then I would say, Graveyard versus Hot Air Balloon would be my personal favorite songs to have written. I think the giveaways for singles were the ones that we chose for singles. Those made sense to be the ones that we had for singles because those are the pop tunes. Those are the catchy ones that are pulling people in. Hey, Ed and Ed are Live. They're fun. I like those tunes and I'm very proud of them. But the thought process and the thought process and the catharsis that came from writing Just for Beasts and the whole idea of a community that came from that production for me was worth the whole album. Yeah. I loved every second of writing that song. It was so fulfilling because, like, just dissecting the song lyric by lyric and all of the harmonic and dynamic stuff that we did to make that song what it is. I would say just before Graveyard versus Hot Air Balloon, it is the most gratifying track on the record for me. Just because it says everything that the record is right there. And next to that, Graveyard versus Hot Air Balloon does. In that it's all about this togetherness and finding self-worth in your community and you know, we are all these broken little toys, but we're very much together. If we're all broken little toys, we're not broken anymore, really, you know, together. Mm-hmm. We're all just making it work. That's what we all are doing anyways. And with Graveyard versus Hot Air Balloon, man, that title is cumbersome. But you know, with that next to it, not at all in track order, but in the order of my own gratification in writing, I thought that one just felt like, for me, whatever Just for Beasts couldn't say in sense of the high and low and polarizing nature of everything, you know, because Just for Beasts, it wasn't, you know, we have to pick and choose what message, like, not every song can carry every single message.
Right.
You know? So that message, in addition to the message of Graveyard versus Hot Air Balloon, really felt like it really just brings everything together, and that it is Just for Beasts, and it is that crazy, crazy length that we have to pick in order to figure out where we belong in society or to whom we belong and how we identify within those confines and whether or not we want to acknowledge those confines in the first place. And it's all so frustrating to see how things are limited by us just creating inclusivity out of creating more exclusivity, and how the most important part is just like, are you happy with you? Mm. You know, And is your community working for you? And do you feel whole and safe and happy in that community? And if you do, that's amazing. And that's what we should all be striving for, rather than to be like, well, I'm ticking these boxes, so that must be me. And it's like, that's totally fine if that is bringing you fulfillment. But if it's not, we don't have to pick and choose right now. We're all just, again, we're all still figuring it out. We're all the broken toys, and we can all just figure it out as slowly or as quickly as we want. And that's okay.
Right.
You know, and I think those two songs say that in a way that is a little easier to translate than probably what I just said.
No, you said it perfectly. And when you're talking about broken toys, I forget what movie it is. It's an old claymation movie. It's
The Island of Broken Toys.
Ah, was it its own movie?
Oh, no. Yeah, I think so.
Really? Okay, sure. Yes, that's exactly what I'm thinking about, is that island. Because they all come together and solve a problem or something, but they were all labeled as broken and thrown away. It's the exact same thing.
Yeah, that is the mental health community, my friend.
I love it.
It's like the first thing, fucking the litany of school shootings that happens in the United States on a fucking monthly basis, the first thing Donald Trump does is says that it's the mental health and those suffering with mental illness. Yeah. And granted, the monsters that do these things need help. they deserve help. But they're still pieces of shit. And Donald Trump is trying to just take all of that and just say, like, nope, it's all of you fucking broken toys. You're all the same. You're all capable of the same horrible shit because you tick all of these boxes. So that's you. And right. I probably said that way, way more articulately than he ever said to his fucking mishmash fucking cabinet there. But that was what, you know, that's like, I remember that exact feeling and that exact sentiment the moment there was like some school shooting that happened. And it's a shame that I can refer to it so generally. But it was so frustrating to be like, that's it. That's all he has to say about it. It's the mental health community.
Right.
It's those suffering with mental illness that are the problem. Again. And it's like, you're missing it, man. You're missing it.
Yeah. I mean, that's been a problem for a long time, is that people just kind of, instead of trying to dive into the root causes and root problems, they kind of just throw the label on and move along.
Well, it's just, we just speak in these big generalities again.
Yeah.
Which is why, you know, partly why I wrote this record in the first place, is to be like, your community doesn't have to be anybody's community but yours.
Right.
If it makes you feel whole and safe and happy and it's not hurting anybody, that's a perfectly valid and legitimate community.
Mm. Yeah.
You know? And that's one that I would like to create around this conversation and this dialogue, is to start a more positive conversation about mental illness and mental health, and to make it so that you and I don't have to just get on a podcast to talk this shit out. Like, it's that there are going to be other people feeling like me and you who, you know, are struggling, who can just talk to one another and not be worried about what, you know, what people don't agree with them and how little they'll be thought of for having that vulnerable moment.
Right. Yeah. I'm hopeful of that. I had a moment just like that. It must have been, I don't even think it was that long ago. I think it was like a week or two ago.
Yeah.
But a guy that, you know, I'm friends with, I'm not like best friends or anything, but we're friends. Yeah. We're at the bar and we just had a super open, honest discussion about his stuff.
Yeah.
He was like, I've never talked about this, but that felt pretty good. Thanks, man. And it's like, dude, we're at a bar and you're just openly talking about this. I think that's incredible.
Yeah,
because that's terrifying.
that's a particularly scary place to open up, because that's where a lot of stuff seems to go to close, you know.
Yeah,
and you know, that's wonderful that you could provide that for your friend, one, and that your friend felt safe and comfortable enough sharing that with you. Is those are those moments that, you know, for us to look at as people who are practicing like true gratitude and like there's so much to be said for even being invited into that scenario, you know?
Yeah.
And that's enormous. That's an enormous thing to be a part of. Cause that could change the way that he talks about this forever.
I know. It's always really nice to hear stuff like that, especially from guys. Like, I know, you know, mental health challenges are universal, but guys never talk about it.
No. And it's, you know, that's when we talk about the suicide rates, people aren't referring to them through female demographics. They're referring to male demographics, and it's not a conversation of, man, it's hard to be a guy, but this is a perfectly navigable way to make it less hard to be a guy. Yeah. And we just have to talk about it. That's the fucking, we are not a marginalized community, because all we have to do is start talking about it.
Yep.
That's it. That's literally all we have to do. We just have to start talking about it. And no one worth any of that time is going to say shit.
It's true. Yeah.
That's the truth. 100%. You know, we have got it. It's not easy, because we're dropping like flies. Like, you just look at the list of musicians who died of killing themselves in the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them are men, you know. That's horrifying and it's sad. But amongst the rest of the people out there who are dropping like flies, none of them get to talk their way out of it, except us. And we can talk our way out of this. We can just talk about it. That's it. That's the first step.
Right.
You know, it's like me talking with you, you talking with me, your friend talking with you at the bar, you providing a safe environment for him to feel able to share that, you know?
Yeah.
It's just, all we have to do is talk.
Right. Now,
it's not that fucking hard.
No, it's not. It's not, but it seems hard. It seems way tougher than it is. Now, when people, like, let's say someone is opening up to someone.
Yeah.
And that person isn't worth your time, but they're like the only kind of, you know, person that other dude has to open up to. Like, they don't have anyone except for this one person. And once you do open up, the reception is not what you're expecting or what you're really looking for. Like, what should they do?
If you don't feel safe sharing something with someone, don't share it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the bottom line for me, is if you're not feeling like what you know, like, so for me, I remember when I, one of the time, so I was hospitalized in 2019, and when that night of the hospitalization, I was with my brother, and I was like, Matt, I'm pretty sure I'm gonna kill myself if we don't go to the doctor right now. And he was like, let's talk about this. And I was like, no. We need to go, like, now. And he didn't need to understand that to know that we had to go then. Even if it was just going to be the Band-Aid for that moment, we needed to hear that as 100%, and we needed to go. If a person cannot provide a space for you to be 100% honest, then they're not necessarily deserving of sharing in that honest space with you that you're trying to provide for them. And it's not to say that it's not worth your time reaching out to say, hey, I need somebody to talk to right now, but there has to be other people. Or you can call the hotline, call suicide hotline, call the emergency room, call whomever. It doesn't fucking matter. There's always somebody to talk to that might not be that person, right? And if that person is throwing up a barrier or being critical in an unnecessary way, or, you know, I remember growing up Catholic is like, and this is probably old news to everybody, but like, you can pray it away, or you can, you know, you can fix it by doing these different acts, then God will do this for you. Or if you fit into his schedule, he's going to help you out in this way. The Lord works in mysterious ways and fucking all that other bullshit. And, you know, that kind of thing is very real. And that's not the space that gets people to a safe space. Unless if it's the one thing that gets you to the next space so you can get to that safe space, that's okay too.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, no, I completely agree. Now, you just released Just for Beasts, and
yeah,
you know, it's a great album. What is next for you guys in terms of music?
So Cecilia and I recorded an album of covers, actually, that we're going to release sometime in 2022, in addition to another record of originals. So we're going to start actually going into the studio for this next record within the next couple months, which is really exciting. We don't have a name for this record yet, but we do have a list of songs that are going to go on it, and we're excited to flesh them out.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be great. And, you know, we're going to be banging the mental health drum as hard as we ever were. And this one feels like it's significantly more about that living in an accountable space and being held accountable for our thoughts and our actions and everything like that, and the role that we play in making changes for ourselves. Because in a lot of ways, you know, like, you know, that there's that old saying of you can't help somebody that doesn't want to be helped. And if you're the person who needs to be helped and you don't want to be helped, you own a part of that. There is, you know, there's a piece of that helping hand that needs to figure out exactly what help looks like to you and how they can meet you in the middle, which is crucial. But it's also really, really important for us to be able to accept help and for us to be able to get to those points where we're ready to accept help. And that's what this next album is going to focus a lot on, is the accountability aspect of mental illness, and that while we are ill and while we are victims of illness, we are still people who can get better, and there is always hope to get better, and we play it the biggest role in that.
Right.
And by that we're accountable.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, I'm pumped to hear that, man. You hope so? Yeah, yeah. I hope it sounds good. I
fucking hope so. if it's terrible.
Yeah, just it didn't happen. If it's bad, it didn't happen.
No. It's blame Harry.
Yeah, blame me. I it was my fault. Sorry, guys. I ruined it. I guess my last question for you, Alex, is
yeah.
You know, you've gone through all this stuff in your life. You found that self-worth. You found therapy almost through music.
Trying.
Yeah. Yeah, you're getting there.
Yeah.
You've gone through all this stuff. What is one thing about life that you've learned that you would want to give to younger you?
It's always way more temporary than we think. Everything is always way more temporary than we think. There is something about understanding how temporary things are that allows you to truly understand that things can always get better. Not that they will, but they can. That's been a huge piece for me, and that we have to make our own hope. You know, that's a huge part for me. I was very, very hopeless when I was a kid, and I was angry because I was hopeless, and I was the two of them fed each other. That anger and that hopelessness just kept feeding off of each other to make a less and less and less and less happy person. And you know, where I started, I remember the start of that anger. It was outward. It wasn't about me. I wasn't angry at me yet. And I learned that I was like angry at everybody because I was hopeless. And then I slowly, it turns into this little cannibal, and then you slowly turn that inwards when there's nobody left to be angry at. And then you get angry at yourself. And there is where you abandon that self-worth, because then you start to find comfort and you find a little home in that self-loathing place that you create for yourself, which is to constantly blame yourself so you can have somebody to blame. So you could constantly say, like, well, I fucked that up because I'm fucked up.
Right.
I guess so. You know, I guess I'm just the worst at this, and that's why this happened. And it's just then you have an excuse for everything, because it's you. The excuse is you.
Right.
And it's really easy to hate that excuse.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah. Great advice. But
I don't want that to be advice. I don't want that to be advice. I don't want to give advice to anybody. That's what I've gone through. I think that anybody who comes off like they figured it all out, they're just full of shit.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't want to be that person. I do not have it figured out. I do not truly understand self-worth yet. I do not truly love myself yet. I'm learning. All of this is just talking about experience. Mm-hmm. I don't want any of that to be. The only advice that I have, and I sent this same response to Indie Is Not a Genre, the only advice I have is that if somebody's feeling unsafe, call the National Suicide Hotline. There's somebody there that will talk with you. Yep. I don't have the number in front of me, but Google it. It's there. If you want to post it on the Instagram story or Instagram post that this podcast will come up with, you know, that would be great, just so it's out there. I don't have any advice other than that. I'm not fit to provide advice to people.
No, that's great. I appreciate that, because, you know, too often you get those people who just say they've got it figured out for the sake of social media or the sake of whatever it is. They're giving advice and they're not, like, I don't know. I'm in the same boat as you, where, like, I've always found that kind of corny. Especially when, sure, it's people like younger guys, because, like, I'm yeah, pretty young, and guys my age or a little young, older than me, are trying to give life advice, and I'm like, dude, you're not even. What are you doing?
Yeah,
you don't know what you're doing yet.
No,
that's why, like, honestly, when I was first, like, getting help and recovering and everything, and I was looking at videos and clips, yeah, and whatever, all these people seemed like they had it figured out, and I was like, are we on the same planet? I was like, am I just that far behind you? It's crazy.
No, they don't have it figured out, and they're not on the same planet as us, because they think they have it figured out. And that's okay. That's a part of their fucking journey and their growth. That's totally fine. I hope it gets there. But the biggest thing is that advice, that those words weigh a lot more than those people think they do.
Right.
And that's the scariest part for me. I think accountability is crucial. And if we can't for a second realize that this, which is getting recorded right now, is going to live for as long as it stays on the internet, which is infinite.
Yeah.
And you know what? I'm not giving advice to anybody. I am not fit to give advice to anybody. I do want somebody to live and learn by their mistakes and the mistakes that I've made that I can share in these kind of conversations like we're having right now. If somebody wants to say, well, Alex fucked that up and Alex is stupid, that's great. That's a fucking lesson learned. Good. You know what? I'm not here to be any piece of advice. I'm here to live by example. And if anybody wants to take this example as a what not to do, they're probably making the right choice.
Love it, man. Now, yeah, obviously, I'm gonna ask for you to play a song to end this whole thing, to cap this whole thing off. But before we get into that, where can people find you? Where can people find the album? Keep up to date with what you guys are doing.
Sure. So you can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Old Tom Music. Online on our website, you can find us at oldtommusic.com, and you can find merch, you can find Instagram posts, you can find media as of photos or videos. If you search Old Tom and the Lookouts with the symbol for and instead of the word. You can find us on YouTube. If you just Google that, I think we're the only ones out there with such an outrageous name. You will be able to find us there, and you'll be able to find our wares, and you can check them out. For music, you can Google, through Spotify, you can find us at Old Tom and the Lookouts, Bandcamp, Old Tom and the Lookouts, SoundCloud, Old Tom and the Lookouts. Music is the same kind of URL set up for all of those.
Awesome, man. I'll put those links down below. I'll also put the National Suicide Hotline as well.
That would be great.
Alex, thank you, man, for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. So I'm gonna play Hey Edna, because that's gonna be the single. Well, that is the single. Oh man, I'm behind. that's the single for this new record that just came out, and yeah, I hope it sounds good.
All right, man.
Usually Cecilia and I do this as a duo, but we recently had a fun little excursion with COVID in my household, and we've been off the grid for a bit. All right. No, it's all right. We got through it, thanks to the vaccine.
There you go.
Hey, Edna. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you just fine.
Sorry you're hurting. You can tell me if it's good enough for now. Hold a spoon beneath the nose, loveless hurting. Just hanging terminal, looking for the out. Drawing lines like something permanent might come. Well, it's graphite anger, stained in both your thumbs. Hey, Edna. Well, I can help with the burning. Turning Polaroids to ash, your favorite version. It must be smoke that got your tear ducts churning. Well, I know crying's not your fashion. I'm sorry, Edna, that you're hurting. Drawing lines like something permanent might come. Those graphite anger, steaming both your thumbs. Ooh, you can say it's good enough for now. I'm still here. Sorry, Edna. Take your time to settle in. I could be your satellite just waiting for you to share what's done with. Sorry, Edna. I'm sorry, Edna. Take your time to settle in. I'm sorry, Edna. Take your time to settle in. I'm sorry, Edna. Take your time to settle in. I'd be your satellite just wait. What's done you in? Hey, yeah, no. You could say it's good enough for now. I'm still here, just hanging out. I'm sorry, Edna. Take your time to settle in. I could be your satellite. Just wait. Just hanging out. I'm sorry, Edna. Take your time to settle in. I could be your satellite just waiting to share what's done. I'm sorry, Edna. I'm sorry, Edna.
Woo! Awesome, man. Thank you. That was awesome.
Oh, thank you. That's so nice of you.
And to all my listeners, I will see you guys next time.